What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Andrea Dunlop is an author, podcaster, and victim advocate from Seattle, Washington. Although her career began in the fictional literary world, Andrea found herself compelled to share her family's experiences, adjacent to the novel she was writing that discussed the disorder Munchausen by proxy. Andrea chose to share her story via her podcast, Nobody Should Believe Me, which has gone on to curate 4 powerful seasons surrounding the often misrepresented topic factitious disorder imposed on another. The Broken Cycle Media team is incredibly grateful that Andrea is joining us to share her knowledge, expertise, and about her own personal journey.
I'm Andrea Dunlop. I'm the author of 5 books, including The Mother Next Door, Medicine, Deception, and Munchausen by Proxy, which is coming out in early 2025 as my first nonfiction book. The others are novels. I am the host and creator of the podcast Nobody Should Believe Me, which is a true crime investigative podcast about Munchausen by Proxy stories. I'm also a member of the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children's Munchausen by Proxy Committee, and the founder of Munchausen Support, which is the nation's only nonprofit dedicated to helping families and survivors of Munchausen by proxy. I grew up on the east side of Seattle. I had a very lovely childhood, still very close with my parents, and was really into books from the time I was a kid. That's the first thing I ever remember thinking I wanted to do with my life when I was a kid was be a novelist. I think fiction is one of the sneakiest ways that you can learn about something or teach someone about something or convey a human experience. I think it's one of the best tools that we have to really walk in their shoes because you are in the head of the characters. I think our guard is down in a really beautiful way. You're not meeting it necessarily with the same framework that you would meet a story in real life. As a creative writing major, after college, I went and worked in book publishing in New York, which was a very main character moment for me because that was one of the jobs that was in all the 90s and 2000s rom-com, like book editor. I lived there for a number of years before moving back here and eventually did get my own books published. I released my 3rd novel, We Came Here to Forget, in 2019. That novel, We Came Here to Forget, the family backstory was based very much on my own family backstory and has to deal with a Munchausen by proxy situation. Munchausen by proxy is the term that we use to describe 2 separate and intertwined things. One is the act of medical child abuse, which is where a parent or caregiver exaggerates, fabricates, or induces illness in their child. That is describing the harm caused to the child. The other thing that we use Munchausen by proxy to describe is the psychiatric condition of factitious disorder imposed on another. And so that is when someone engages in those behaviors for the purposes of sympathy, attention, for an intrinsic emotional reward. There is an underlying psychiatric condition. There's also a very high instance of comorbidities with the cluster B personality disorders. So that's histrionic, borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder. There's a lot of that going on too, but it's very important for people to understand that it is very serious. It has a high death rate between 6 and 9%, according to the most well-known study. this person who's at the center of the investigation. 96% of cases, it's a mother of children who's the perpetrator. The reason it's mostly women is that it's a crime of opportunity. My sort of working thesis, as I've looked at all of these cases and as I've become a mom myself and seen how strong gender roles still are around parenting, women are the people that have the opportunity to commit this abuse by and large. That's who we expect to take care of children. The perpetrators are not suffering from delusions. They understand right and wrong, and they understand what they're doing. So while the psychiatric issues are interesting to think about, I very much admire my colleagues that think about how to treat perpetrators and how to have some of those interventions. It is very well recognized to not be very treatable, and it is not something that reduces a person's culpability for their behavior. It's a big problem in the way that this is dealt with on the criminal level and within the child welfare system is this idea, oh, this is a sick mom who needs help. That may well be true, but the question that those entities that are there to protect children should be answering is this a parent that can safely parent their child? Is this child safe in the home? If the answer is no, then you need to act accordingly. That's not because you don't have any sympathy for the mother, or you're not trying to understand how she could be helped. We treat it very differently than we treat other forms of child abuse, like physical abuse cases or abusive head trauma cases. You're looking at, did that parent hit their child? Did that parent cause harm to their child? You're not looking at, does that parent have some psychological condition that would cause them to hurt their child? You're looking at the actual injuries and the circumstances. It really is important that people understand that we do not need to look at this primarily as a psychiatric condition. We need to accept as a society that there are people who are not going to be safe around children. Just the same way that if someone has committed an act of child sex abuse, we consider that person not a safe adult. We need to draw that line with this form of abuse. A lot of the coverage of these cases that you'll see in the media is very fixated on the gruesome number of surgeries the child had and that they had this organ removed. Yeah, those details are really horrifying, and I don't think we should shy away from them because I think they help us understand the physical harm. But we also need to remember there's a child at the center of this. The psychological and emotional manipulation is so intense that I think that that is actually the part that leaves almost the worst scars. It's very destructive. It's very harmful to others. The other thing that people look for when someone commits a very heinous act is a history of abuse in that person's life. I think one of the ways that people interact with true crime and interact with horrifying stories is to find a way to put some distance between that person and themselves, that family and themselves, and say, well, this would never happen to me because we don't have this kind of family that would produce a person like this. There is no history of abuse in a lot of the perpetrators' histories. In some, there is, because that's just the human population. I can tell you that I did not come from any kind of harmful family. My strongest memories of my sister's behavior started in high school. There was an incident where she started losing her hair, and then my mother took her to a dermatologist to see why she was having this alopecia, which is just the medical term for hair loss. The dermatologist pulled her aside and said, your daughter is shaving her hair. That was obviously a very notable fabrication. And at the same time, she's a teenager. Teenagers do weird stuff for attention. I don't think it just stuck out as a sort of deep psychiatric thing. I think my mom tried to convince her to get counseling. You're not going to get a 17-year-old into counseling if they don't want to be there. When we were in our 20s, she had a twin pregnancy that turned out to be fabricated. Certainly that was a very disturbing one. That was a months-long ruse. It's very believably executed. I really believe she was pregnant. We threw her baby shower, the whole nine yards. The reason I talk about those two incidences are because those are the two that I know for sure were instances of her faking sort of health-adjacent stuff. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff. When you sort of look back at our childhoods together, that seems like part of the pattern. Could another kid do the exact same thing and it be completely benign? Of course. Deceptive behavior in a kid doesn't necessarily totally stick out. It's one of those things that you see in retrospect. We certainly did not have even the language for it or the framing for it at the time. Before I had that book out, I'd really never talked about anything very personal online or in the media. I'd really just been doing my books and had a presence that way, but really hadn't divulged this information anywhere. I released my third novel, We Came Here to Forget. When that book came out, I made the decision that I did want to talk openly about it, because at that point in my life, I had never met anybody else that had been through a case. I never had met anyone who really knew anything about it, with the exception of our family doctor. I just felt incredibly isolated with our family's experience. The book and the podcast were coming to be simultaneously. I was working with a producer on another podcast project at the time. I was already a huge podcast listener. I love podcasts. I was a huge fan of shows like Serial and Shit Town, those really in-depth documentary style, true crime, deep dive, character-based shows. So I set out to make the first season of Nobody Should Believe Me. When I went into the show, I really thought, I'm going to talk about how I have a family connection to this because I want people to understand where I'm coming from. I want to be upfront with my lens that I see this through and sort of all the baggage that I bring to this. I'm not an objective reporter and I'm not going to pretend to be one. So that was important to me. The decision to talk about that publicly, as I did in the second season, that was a really scary decision. That was something I never had imagined doing to that extent. I worked on most of the second season while I was pregnant with my second child. It's tough material. It's very distressing. I spent a lot of time over the first two seasons digging into my own family history, looking into the investigation against my sister for her younger daughter. We'd been estranged for a long time, so I've never met her daughter. That investigation went from March of 2018 to April of 2020, two-year-long police investigation that was referred to the prosecuting attorney, and the prosecuting attorney declined to file charges. I started digging into that case, and I was shocked at how much was in the public record about that case and how much I was able to uncover. I was so horrified by the fact that despite the strength of the evidence that I was able to find that information in the police reports, the prosecuting attorney had let it go and had not filed charges. And I was so angry about that and worried about my niece and nephew. I then made the choice to air all that out and say everything I knew, say my sister's real name. I did that because I felt like that was the best thing I could do to keep more eyes on those kids and to any small degree hold the people who I felt put them back in harm's way to account. I was a brand new mom at that time, and it was an experience that had really come back up for me. I certainly had lots of conversations with my parents about it before I did it. I'm still very close with my parents. They're also estranged from my sister. I talked to my husband about it, obviously. They were all very supportive. I was amazed after that episode aired that I really felt like a huge weight had lifted. That is one of the best things that something like a true crime podcast can do for the person making it and for the people who are on it. There is a really intrinsic value in sharing your story. I think there's a value to the people who hear it. My sister, she was really angry. We had a little bit of legal back and forth over it. After I read all these pages of documentation and just knew all these details that I couldn't unknow, I just thought, I can't be the person that carries this around. I can't be the person that knows this and just isn't saying anything. The pandemic happened. It became my pandemic project that I could sink myself into. I had most of those first two seasons in the can by the time we launched because of some delays. We ended up launching in the fall of 2022. I set out to make Nobody Should Believe Me as a limited series, partly because of funding, because I made it myself in the beginning. It did not strike me as this is going to be a commercially viable project and this is my big career pivot into podcasting. Of course, I hoped it would succeed and I thought people would be interested in it, but we really took off in kind of the middle of our second season and having other people tell me their incredibly vulnerable stories. No one's ever on my show to talk about anything fun and light, right? It's like everyone is always talking to me about the very worst thing that ever happened to them in their life. And I take that really seriously, especially in the case of the survivors themselves. A lot of amazing people have told me their stories and have shared their voices with the show. You worry about blowback from the parent. If that parent's still alive, you worry about that setting them back in their own healing process. You worried about what the internets are going to say, especially once the show had an audience. I've become really concerned by that. It's having gone through that and my own experience of talking about my own story, it really helped for me reinforce there are risks to doing that. And there's also potentially a huge benefit. That's also a really nice thing to be able to help people tell their stories and to be able to do my best to do that in a way that does it with dignity and care. In the course of talking about it publicly, a journalist friend introduced me to Dr. Mark Feldman, who's one of really the top experts in the world on Munchausen by proxy. His books are excellent. He is the author of 5 books on the subject of medical deception and factitious disorders. He's an incredible expert. He's been in the field for over 30 years and is really the most well-known person who does this kind of work. He and I met and chatted. He's become a very dear friend and mentor over the years. As we were talking about my own backstory and the work he does, he encouraged me to come and meet with this committee that he's on as part of the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children, which is a big umbrella organization that is cross-disciplinary, all kinds of people that work with all different kinds of child abuse. I came and met with this committee and was just really blown away by this group of professionals. I told them my story. It can be harrowing to try and explain this kind of story to someone. You sort of have to deal with their shock and their dismay. People would burst into tears. I would be like, well, this is not helpful for my processing to like now be having to sort of manage this conversation on the other end. I remember telling it to this group of professionals and just seeing them nodding, watching how this story was checking boxes for them. It was incredible. And it made me feel like I had found my people in a way. Oh, this is not shocking for them. They have heard all of this before. I was very inspired by the work they were doing. We had child abuse pediatricians and other people that were working in pediatrics, psychiatrists, psychologists, incredible academics, incredible people in the field who just really dedicated a huge part of their careers to this form of abuse that is so misunderstood, that is so stigmatized, that's so difficult and complicated. I was very bolstered by the efforts of these people. I also went to a full day training on Munchausen by proxy. So I went to that. A bunch of the committee members were leading that training. One of the presentations was by Detective Mike Weber, who is the leading law enforcement expert on Munchausen by proxy in the country. He has more investigations of this kind of abuse under his belt, far more convictions than anyone else in the country. So he gave a presentation along with Sheriff Bill Wayburn, who is the sheriff of Tarrant County. So he's Mike's boss and is also the adoptive father of a survivor. They gave an incredibly moving and informative presentation. As I was sitting there in this training, putting together, how can I help the committee, which I later joined? What skill set can I bring to this? I have a background as a publicist and then also just as a storyteller. I was like, these are stories that need to be told. And that is something that I'm actually equipped to do. I don't have as many PhDs as everyone else in the room, and I'm not going to be doing this academic research, and I'm not going to be testifying in court. I'm not going to be doing medical record reviews, but this is a piece that I can help do that I'm uniquely equipped to do. I really absorbed everything everyone had to say. I met Mike Weber. I was chatting with him, and he said, "Aw, shucks, people are always telling me I should write a book." And I was like, "You should." And I don't say that lightly. But with Mike, I was like, yeah, you're the leading law enforcement expert on a very specific and very strange phenomenon. Yes, you should write a book on it. This is a book that should exist in the world. So for a while, I tried to help him put together a proposal and everything. And then as the months went by and we got to know each other better, finally, I just said, "Hey, Mike, why don't we co-write this thing?" Threw myself in the deep end of that, which is my sort of usual MO that is coming out from St. Martin's Press February 4th of next year, called The Mother Next Door, Medicine, Deception, and Munchausen by Proxy. We are going to go in depth on 3 cases. That was a massive undertaking, writing a nonfiction book. I had to stick to the facts, which I do not have to do in my fiction writing. So that was a huge labor of love. I hope that it really gives people a deeper understanding of what this abuse looks like. My biggest thing is I want people to understand that it's real. I want people to understand that Gypsy Rose Blanchard is not the only person that this has ever happened to. Obviously, that is the story that most people have heard, if they have heard of it at all. There was many twists of that. conspiring for her mother's murder and the jail time and all of it has been compelling. I'm glad that people heard her story. I think there are many elements of that story that have so many parallels with other stories. And I think what people need to understand is there are other gypsies that have not had their story heard. Survivors are incredibly isolated. This is not a form of abuse that we have a lot of good studies about because it's very hard to get funding to study it. And that is something that all of my colleagues on the committee have really struggled with. Since it was first identified in the 1970s, we go through these huge waves of pushback about basically the existence of this abuse at all. We're in the midst of one right now. There are a number of people who are very loud, who are taking up a lot of space that would like you to believe that this is not real, that this is a form of abuse that does not happen. The doctors who coined the term, who wrote the original paper, were vilified in their home country. They were taken off the medical registry. They were reinstated, but that part never gets told. So frequently the media describes them as disgraced doctors. They are not disgraced doctors. The actual medical and scientific community very much accepts that Munchausen by proxy abuse is real, but there is a lot of cultural conversation about it that unfortunately just pushes back the ability to even study it. So they're not good overall statistics. The thing that every expert that I have talked to has ever told me is that they believe that it is far more common than people believe it to be. Since I've had this show on the air, hearing from a lot of survivors, talking to a lot of survivors, talking to a lot of family, the number of people who listen to the show and have written into me and said, I've either realized that this is something that happened to me, or I realize it's something that's going on in my family. That anecdotally definitely underscores for me that it is not as rare as people believe it to be. I believe all but one of the survivors I've ever met have either stayed with their abuser or were removed from their abuser for a short time and then given back. The adjudication rate, I think, is pretty abysmal. It's something that is not treated very seriously by the courts. Even when there is a conviction, you tend to see a lot of people get probation. Sometimes they get their kids taken away for a period of time, sometimes permanently, but most of the time people get away with it. To be totally frank, this is not a crime that is taken seriously or well handled by either the child welfare system or the courts. They tend to be very onerous cases to investigate because they involve sometimes tens of thousands of pages of medical records that someone who is probably not being paid to do that has to review. That person has to be an expert. And they're just incredibly complex. We are not good at holding perpetrators accountable. We are not good at helping kids that are in this situation. That's just to say, I think there is very strong evidence that this is much more common than most people believe. I don't think we have any sort of reliable statistics, and hopefully one day we will. Most of the time, you are not going to see an outcry from a child victim because the child doesn't understand that they're being abused. There's a huge psychological component to this abuse that is extremely cult-like. It's extremely pervasive. When they're older, when they're a teenager, 10 plus, come to understand that something is off or that there is some deception happening around their illness, even in that case, they may act protective of their parent because they understand that their parent would be in trouble. They are often being coached behind the scenes to say that they are having certain symptoms. You are sick, and if you don't tell the doctor this, they won't believe you and you won't get the help you need and then you'll die. So there's an incredible amount of fear that gets instilled in them. So children often believe that their health conditions are real, and even if they are starting to suspect that they might not be all real, they're very worried about the consequences of their parent being found out. You see people mostly realizing later in their life when they're able to, hopefully, in the best case scenario, get some space from that abusive adult. That's when you see them realizing that they were a victim of abuse. They're looking through their medical records and they see these sort of strange patterns or deceptions, or even they see that they've been flagged for abuse. They see that their parent was reported, or they know their parent was reported because they ended up going to court. So it's something that really adult survivors are left to put the pieces back together. It's not something where you see an outcry coming from a child. The statute of limitations varies state to state, but from the sort of criminal justice perspective, it's something where you have to have evidence, obviously. And the more time that's passed, you're not going to have things like blood samples that parent has tampered with. It's going to be harder to track down video surveillance. It's hard enough to get the police to do anything about it when a child is in danger. One of the things I think that people don't quite understand about the criminal justice system is that it's full of people who are making people decisions at every point. So you have to have a motivated detective. The DA has to have the will to pursue it. all of these things have to be in place for anything to actually happen. I have seen some survivors try and get a sibling death reinvestigated. It's very tricky. I think people don't realize how many violent crimes just go unsolved, unaccounted for. Most of these fall in that unfortunate large category. I run a tiny nonprofit with the help of a couple of incredible colleagues. We do peer support groups. We really just help triage people's requests to the various professionals on the committee. And that's the only dedicated support there is for people who are Munchausen by proxy survivors. It is a very specific experience. The cases all have such strong parallels. Being able to have that peer support and talking to other people who've been through a case is very grounding. Munchausensupport.com is where you can find a lot of information that will help you. And it's also where you can get help if you need it, either if you suspect someone in your life is a perpetrator or a survivor. I say that because I would want to pass people off to professionals that are far more equipped to deal with that than myself. The best thing we can all do is be in community with each other. And I'm very proud of creating sort of a portal for that.
Thank you for creating that and for sharing it. Are there any other nonprofits you'd want to give a shout out to or that have been helpful or informative?
Definitely APSAC as a professional organization. They're a great organization. They are, again, that huge umbrella organization. They support all different kinds of research into child abuse. That's a great one to check out. And then also the other one I would send people to if they're feeling concerned, as I am feeling concerned about the state of how we are dealing with child abuse right now. There's a wonderful organization called Prevent Child Abuse America that does a lot of research and evidence back early intervention programs for families. That is a wonderful organization that is dedicated to preventing child abuse so that those situations of family removals do not have to ever happen and those children are never harmed in the first place. They are doing incredible work and they have been at it for decades. They've gotten bipartisan legislation passed. What a miracle. There are obviously lots of organizations that deal with child abuse survivors and deal with various forms of child abuse, but they often don't know anything about Munchausen by proxy. And it's very, very hard for survivors to find help. Often they just encounter a lot of disbelief too. They may encounter people in the medical establishment then questioning them about whether they're lying about their illnesses. So that can be extremely re-traumatizing. The lack of awareness does very real harm to survivors and also family members who've been through cases. Most of us end up educating our therapist about this rather than the other way around. So that's certainly something I would like to see change and feels possible to change. The research that my colleagues are doing and figuring out, is early intervention possible? Is it possible to work with someone who's doing those behaviors to themselves and help them develop healthier ways to get their emotional needs met so that it doesn't ever escalate, especially before that person ends up becoming a parent and then possibly doing it to their children? So I do think it's worth thinking about what could our early identifiers be. And I think it's important for doctors to have understandings about these behaviors. Anyone who's in the medical profession is going to have at least one patient that is engaging in Munchausen behaviors. Anyone in pediatrics is going to have at least one situation, probably more, where the parent is engaging in Munchausen by proxy behaviors. So it's really important to have awareness. Would it have made a difference? Who knows? But I wish that dermatologist had said, your daughter's doing this and it could be Munchausen behavior. There are no easy answers about who becomes a perpetrator of this abuse, except that there aren't any easy answers as to why. There certainly is usually a very long-standing pattern of deception, often around medical things. Often perpetrators have a history of factitious disorder imposed on self. So it's Munchausen syndrome, where people make themselves sick for intrinsic emotional purposes, for sympathy, for attention, et cetera. So Hope Yabar had that history. My sister had that history. That's pretty common. Sometimes you don't see it, but there usually is some kind of history around histrionic behavior, deception, financial fraud, infidelity. It's not a totally isolated behavior. You don't just see someone who has lived a completely straightforward, honest life until they do this suddenly out of the blue. So it certainly is attached to a previous behavior. It's very hard to wrap your head around the fact that someone would tell really elaborate lies about something so serious. And it just is incredibly disorienting. I think that talking to other people or reading about other cases, listening to the show, can really help you sort through and have that moment of, no, I'm not crazy. This is happening. That's step one. If you're a survivor, to unpacking your own experience and trying to get a handle on what happened to you. And that's step one. If you're a person that is trying to be a protective adult in a kid's life, wrapping your arms around what is actually happening. What a lot of people report is what my parents and I went through for a long time with my sister, which is just a very strong feeling that something was off, but no language for it. So I think it really is important to have the language for it. Researching the cases can be super gnarly. The other things that you uncover and all these layers of deceptions, and you do feel like you're putting together a 1,000-piece puzzle. I tend to read about those cases and see all of the opportunities that someone could have stepped in and didn't. That will sort of put me in a little bit of a hole. I sort of tend to plan around when I'm doing that kind of research. I've become pretty attuned to knowing when I need to walk away from my computer and take a break, especially when I was researching my sister's case. My daughter is currently the age that her daughter was when that was happening. So it's hard to have that strong of a visual. Kids are so amazing at bringing you back into the moment, especially little kids, because they just live in the moment. I really find that stepping away from it and tuning into what my kids are doing and being like, all right, it is time for like Play-Doh right now. It's time to watch some Bluey right now. Seeing friends in real life, getting out, doing some exercise. That's been one of my long-term coping mechanisms. You can find Nobody Should Believe Me wherever you listen to podcasts. June 20th, we have our season 4 premiere. So we are really deep in working on season 4. I am so excited to share that season with people. I think it's going to be a really beautiful and really hopeful season. I also have a website, AndreaDunlop.net, where you can find all of my authorly things going on. I'm also on Instagram. That is the only social media network I'm paying attention to and being on these days because I can't handle being on all of them.
I really appreciate this. Even though we talked about some hard stuff, you really do give me hope for victims of Munchausen by proxy and medical abuse and for the way that our systems receive the victims. Thank you for everything that you do.
Oh, thank you for having me, Amy. It's been a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I could earn the right to sleep inside as opposed to sleeping in the compost. I was shoveling compost day in, day out. Terrible experience. There's a deep sense of shame because everybody else has had all these pivotal high school experiences. Some people have learned how to play instruments. Other people have discovered that they love to perform in plays, and I have just left a warehouse for children where for years I've just been heavily medicated and getting slammed to the ground for looking at girls.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.